Okay, so we backtracked a bit in this book, come back to Ajahn Amaro's chapter on knowing emptiness and the radiant mind, and just to go over some of the aspects of emptiness or sunyata that are really important, also because. When I address it in my chapters in terms of practices and perspectives, then I kind of skimped a bit because Ajahn Amaro had already covered it. And then there's a as we get toward the end of what Ajahn Amaro wrote, then he's also, he said, well, I don't have to say too much because it's going to be addressed in.
In the
So
coming
we're
chapters.
both sort of weaseling out of. And, okay, so the last set of points that were being made were around the aspect of the different forms of vimokkha, or liberations, emancipations, that the animitta vimokkha. Is accessed through the contemplation of impermanence, Panahita vimokkha, the liberation through desirelessness is accessed through contemplation of dukkha, and then the sunyata vimokkha, the liberation through emptiness, is accessed through the contemplation of not self, of anatta. So just to remind people of that, these are different trajectories that one can take one's contemplation or reflection investigation, and they lead to a a releasing of the mind. In contrast to the previous two discourses, in this next one, which arguably forms the Buddha's most extensive teaching on emptiness in the Pali Canon, the term is used in a somewhat different way, forming a quote-unquote nest of contemplations of ever-increasing subtlety, leading to the stopping of the outflows, the asava, and liberation. So this discourse is the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the lesser discourse on on emptiness, and it is in the middle length discourses 121, and it says this is a fair chunk of the whole sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in the eastern part, in the palace of Megara's mother. Then, when it was evening, the Venerable Ananda rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at a town of the Sakyans named Nagarika. There, Venerable Sir, I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Now, Ananda, I often abide in emptiness. And the Pali for that is sunyata viharenaham ananda etarhi bahulang viharamiti. Did I hear that correctly, Venerable Sir? Did I learn that correctly? Attend to that correctly? Remember that correctly? Certainly, Ananda, you heard that correctly, learned that correctly, attended to that correctly, remembered that correctly. As formerly, Ananda, so now, So now, too, I often abide in emptiness. Ananda, just as this palace of Megara's mother is empty of elephants, cattle, horses, and mares, empty of gold and silver, empty of the assembly of men and women, and there is present only this non-emptiness, namely, the singleness dependent on the Sangha of bhikkhus, so too, a bhikkhu, not attending to the perception of village, not attending to the perception of people, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of forest. His mind enters into that perception of forest and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of village, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of people, those are not present here. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely, the singleness dependent on the perception of forest. Thus he regards it as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present. Thus, this is present. Thus, Ananda, this is his genuine, undistorted, pure entry into emptiness. Again, Ananda, a bhikkhu, not attending to the perception of people, not attending to the perception of forest, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. That is, like, in terms of the element, the earth element, dhatu. His mind enters into that perception of earth and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. Just as a bull's hide becomes free from folds when fully stretched with 100 pegs, so too a bhikkhu, not attending to any of the ridges and hollows of this earth, to the rivers and ravines, the tracks of stumps and thorns, the mountains and uneven places, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. His mind enters into that perception of earth and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of people, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of forest, those are not present here. There is present here only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. He understands. This field of perception is empty of the perception of people. This field of perception is empty of the perception of forest. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of earth. Thus he regards it as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure entry into emptiness. Again, Ananda, a bhikkhu, not attending to the perception of forest, not attending to the perception of earth, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. His mind enters into that perception of the base of infinite space and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of forest, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of earth, those are not present here. There is present here only this amount of disturbance, namely, the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. He understands. This field of perception is empty of the perception of forest. This field of perception is empty of the perception of earth. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. Thus he regards it as empty of what is not there, But as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure entry into emptiness. Then he's elided here. So too with the basis of infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception. These are the four formless realms or formless attainments. Again, Ananda, a bhikkhu, not attending to the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception, attends to the singleness dependent on the signless concentration of mind, animita jeto samadhi. His mind enters into that signless concentration of mind and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. He understands thus, whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of the base of nothingness, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the perception of neither perception nor non-perception, those are not present here. There is present here only this amount of disturbance, namely that connected with the six sense bases that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. He understands. This field of perception is empty of the perception of the base of nothingness. This field of perception is empty of the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely, that connected with the six sense bases that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. Thus he regards it as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure entry into emptiness. Again, Ananda, a bhikkhu attends to the singleness dependent on the signless concentration of mind. His mind enters into that signless concentration of mind and acquires confidence, steadiness, and decision. He understands thus. This signless concentration of mind is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. When he knows and sees thus, his heart is liberated from the outflow of sensual desire, from the outflow of becoming, and from the outflow of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is ended. The holy life has been lived out. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. He understands thus. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the outflow of sensual desire, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the outflow of becoming, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be dependent on the outflow of ignorance, those are not present here. There is present here only this amount of disturbance, namely, that connected with the six sense bases that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. He understands. This field of perception is empty of the outflow of sensual desire. This field of perception is empty of the outflow of becoming. This field of perception is empty of the outflow of ignorance. There is present only this non-emptiness, namely, that connected with the six sense bases that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. Thus he regards it as empty of what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this is his genuine, undistorted, pure entry into emptiness, supreme and unsurpassed. Ananda, whatever samanas and brahmins in the past, the future, or the present enter upon and abide in pure, supreme, unsurpassed emptiness, all enter upon and abide in this same pure, supreme, unsurpassed emptiness. Therefore, Ananda, you should train thus. We will enter upon and abide in pure, supreme, unsurpassed emptiness. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's, yeah, a very important teaching. Oh, probably. I think to sort of get one's mind around, because emptiness is something that is, let's say, it is a concept that is common in these days in amongst the different schools of Buddhism, or if you've read about Buddhism, you've heard about emptiness, but it's helpful, I think, to see what the, say, how the Buddha was using it as a tool to recognize letting go, relinquishing, non-abiding, non-focusing, or not entangling oneself with something. That is its, that creates an emptiness. And so, yeah, if you're this empty of elephants, cattle, horses, mares, and it's, you know, it's empty. Of course, then the Buddha takes it and refines it increasingly through the different practices and meditations through to the formless attainments, and then also taking because neither perception or non-perception is seriously refined, there is this non-emptiness that is still experienceable, and that's the this fact that this is body and the senses, and the same when taking that, even that refinement of concentration, the Buddha then takes it to the sense of a singleness dependent on the signless an insight into the signless nature of the mind, or the animitta, so that one isn't grasping after anything that is impermanent, because it's what is there's you're looking at a characteristic, and so that you're not getting swept up in the sign making, and it is that sense of say, yeah, nimitta is like is that which shows a sign, an indication of some kind of existence, and you realize, no, that which is arising and ceasing is fundamentally insubstantial, but it's also conditioned and volitionally produced. So it's not that which is of a conditioned nature has to be impermanent and subject to cessation. So then that allows the mind to relinquish the outflows of sense desire, of becoming, of ignorance, so that the mind really pulls back from its and the I-making, the mind-making, the underlying tendencies to conceit, ahankara, mamankara, mananusaya. It's a really important, because we're constantly trying to get a hold on something, to be able to attend to the impermanence of things. But even when one talks of that emptiness of the outflows, there's still the body and the sense bases. I mean, as long as we have life, we're going to experience that. And as long as you've got the sense bases and a bodily existence, it's going to be fraught with pleasant sensation, unpleasant sensation, neutral sensation. It's just the nature of it. But it's seen through and seen as fundamentally empty, which doesn't disregard it or push it away or dismiss it as just illusion and therefore meaningless. It's meaningful in the sense that it's all can be a basis of insight and relinquishment. So, anyway, those are some thoughts on an important sutta. and again, just to highlight that, because there has been a tendency in Buddhist history to put emptiness with a capital E and almost a metaphysical existence, and the Buddha is said, no, it's empty of this, and the ability to not reify anything.
Yeah, I think that the succession that you get, the sort of very matter of fact, like no elephants, no horses, then through the sort of the forest, then the earth element, and then next thing you know, you're in the realm of infinite space. It's
right. Yeah, somehow it's not my experience.
So they come in the same breath and the same tone. It's like, oh, all right, okay, buckle up. You know.
Buckle up, yeah.
It's a kind of remarkable matter-of-factness. But it's also, I think, that in a sense, that not being remarkable is like that.
Yeah,
these are just conditioned forms that are being experienced, and so... these can be handled and related to in exactly the same way, reflected upon in exactly the same way. And so, according to our ordinary everyday experience, that's quite a jump. But that's in the sort of the tone, the flow of that teaching is just, well, no, this is, it all comes in the same category. It's all sort of to be understood and reflected on in exactly the same way. It's just because it's infinite space. Doesn't mean that the mind has to be daunted by that or it's seen as anything kind of special or magical.
What comes to mind is Lumpa Cha, Kenan, and sort of just that much. It's only that much. You know? So even emptiness, it's only that much. Any questions?
Yeah. Am I right in thinking the other day you were mentioning when the Buddha has got backache and the only time he gets relief is it in the signless concentration of mind? Is that right?
Yeah.
But then there still seems to be that non-emptiness connected with the six sense bases. So there must be kind of relief from the backache, but there's still some kind of...
Well, he's still got to come back into his body. Oh. The body didn't go anywhere. As long as you've still got the life force, then you've still got an old breaking down body.
But within that sinus concentration of mind, do you understand that there is still that, you know, that disturbance connected with the body, or is it?
I mean, it's relief from that, because one is in that sinus concentration, one is within the concentration. The limitation of that is that it's not permanent. So that one is still then heir to the foibles of having a human body and a life force that's still there. Yeah.
The descriptions of the formless states don't entirely seem to correlate with what we've read before, because if I remember right, other suttas, first off, they don't mention the when the formless jhanas, they don't mention contemplating rupa, which would seem to mean that perhaps only the mind sense would be active. The body is no longer, body is no longer perceived. But then also, in a previous sutta, it was mentioned that the, you know, neither perception nor non-perception is too subtle to contemplate.
Yeah.
And so I guess, I imagine the commentaries somehow reconcile this.
Well, I'll bet they'll jump through some pretty imaginary hoops in order to try to reconcile it. And I'd go with what the Buddha says. And I think it's important to recognize that one can take a look at that in terms of, you think in terms of contemplation, neither perception nor non-perception is too refined to contemplate within it. But then that as a state that one has recognized, then you're really, it is dependent on the six sense bases and conditioned by life. And that's not, might not be reflecting on that in that moment, but is recognizing, that's why I'm still here. But in particular that taking it to the stemming of the asavas, you're not necessarily contemplating the attainment at that time. You're looking back at all the various mental states that one can experience and has experienced and probably will experience. But seeing it in the light of that impermanence, unsatisfactory, non-self nature. That makes sense now?
Yeah.
Also, sometimes I think it's wonderful that the Buddha's not 100% consistent.
Oscar Wilde said, consistency is the last refuge of the unimaginative. Just drop that into the mix.
I guess a follow-up question would be, is that have you found these sort of the instructions for contemplating, these formless realms, have you found those instructions or those patterns helpful in your own practice?
Not particularly.
Okay.
And that's not because the instructions aren't useful. It's just, I'm stuck with my mind. I'm much more conduit. Okay, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. The rising and passing of the five khandhas. The experience of neither perception nor non-perception is a bit too refined for me. Yes.
Is my understanding correct that everything is empty, nothing is there, from the horses to the absorption?
Well, it's not, but it's also the Buddha's use of emptiness is that it is empty of this much. What still remains is this.
And this is the body and the senses, right?
Yeah.
So then when the body dies,
yeah,
and with it the senses, then that also kind of disappears in the same way that the horses disappear.
Yes, but then it's also then. But if the asavas are still functioning, and it's then your karmic impetus or karmic momentum will then take one to further birth.
But beside that, like, it still sounds to me like that description a little bit like nothingness, and that's, like, you know, like, as if it, like, if there's the karma, then there's something there, but there is, if there's no karma left.
Yeah, well, that's where it gets back into the elements of the the unapprehendability of the enlightened, and or the because it's not a categorical empty nothingness. What's that quote? I mean, you've quoted all the time of the Buddha not being measured or not being.
So in the Buddha's dialogue with Vajragata, he says, and Vajragata's asked, what happens to an enlightened being at the death of the body? Where do they reappear? The Buddha says, reappears, doesn't apply, does not reappear, does not apply. Both reappears and does not, does not reappear, doesn't apply. Neither reappears, nor does not reappear, doesn't apply. You know, the way you're asking the question, Vajra, it implies a reality that doesn't exist. And then he uses that wonderful analogy of where did the fire go, north, south, east, or west? You know, if I asked you that question, what would you say? Well, the question doesn't apply. Exactly. So to ask where does an enlightened being go when the body dies, it's where doesn't apply, being doesn't apply, going doesn't apply, you know, time, location, identity, none of those apply. So the Buddha then says, that material form that one would use when trying to describe the Tathagata, that has been cut off at the root, made like a palm tree stump, deprived from the conditions for existence, and been rendered incapable of arising in the future. So to feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, the Tathagata is liberated from being reckoned in terms of form, feeling, perception, and mental formations, consciousness. He is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the great ocean. So that quality of presence, the word Tathagata refers to, has completely dropped or let go of the five khandhas. The bridge is down. There is no connection. But they're having a dialogue. Right there, there's the body and life is there. So that there's absolutely no identification with the five khandhas, but there is the Buddha as a living being having a conversation with Vajragata as another living being. So that it kind of represents that same kind of dynamic of complete letting go of everything, but there are still the senses and life. And then when the body passes away, the Buddha is absolutely stoic in not giving. He said, you know, it can't be spoken about because all the usual reference points are gone. And in the dialogue with Upasiva in the Sutta Nipata, then when Upasiva asks the same kind of question, he says, so one who has reached the end of their practice, when the body passes away, do they no longer exist? Or do they enter some kind of transcendent, blissful state? And the Buddha says, one who has reached the end has no criterion by which they can be measured. That which can be spoken of is no more. You cannot say they don't exist, but when all means of speaking or phenomena are removed, so all modes of being or phenomena are removed, all means of speaking have gone too.
So with all of that, actually, I get more of a sense of that it's not nothing, it's not oblivion, it's not...
It's not nothing, but it's not... But any kind of reference point of a being in time, in a location... Mm-hmm. None of those apply, and so the Buddha, when people would language things in terms of being one with the allness of the all, the Buddha say no. That language stops at the barrier, at that border. It's like language concept. And again, I think it's absolutely kind of marvelous that the Buddha just stoically says, nope, no matter how clever or wonderful or poetic your descriptions are, doesn't apply.
And yet in this sutta, it sounds to me like to my ears when I would read that, mm-hmm. that it sounds like nothingness. So is that a skillful means because there is a strong grasping in the minds of people that, you know, like one puts it rather this way, like strongly as if it wouldn't exist?
Well, in that sutta, the Buddha's talking about emptiness in terms of absence rather than emptiness in terms of transparency, which is a bit of a distinction to make. So he's saying those things are absent, but what is here? It's empty of horses and elephants and so on to begin with, or it's empty of earth, it's empty of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But what is here? So it's talking about emptiness in terms of a thing which is not there, and emptiness of absence. So another way of relating to emptiness is say empty of substance or empty of... kind of use the word transparency, that there's a form there, but there's nothing solid. But this is talking about you just really using that emptiness in terms of a thing which is not there. But what does remain is these qualities which appear to be things.
Mm. Yeah, because this is, again, this is where the Buddha's use of the term empty is kind of quite different than the later schools of Buddhism that come up with an emptiness as a metaphysical or philosophical idea or ideal. And the Buddha his relationship to it is much more prosaic.
I think that's where I get it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It's not a philosophical position. You're
mapping it on to the inherited kind of things that we, because it is such it pervades all the different schools of Buddhism.
There's another short teaching of the Buddha, which where he, I can't quote it exactly, but he basically says, I make two kinds of statements. Statements where you should draw implications from these statements, and statements which you should not draw implication, you know, you should not draw out further, you know, try to tease out what exactly this means. Yeah. And the Buddha was aware that people had a tendency to do that and cautioned about it.
Blessed are the cheesemakers. Oh, really, anyone involved in the dairy industry is what we're talking about here.
Yes.
Towards the end of the sutta, you were mentioning abiding in the emptiness. Does that mean like abiding in the mind that has let go of everything, like the five criteria?
I would say that's what it's pointing to is an abiding in that letting go, relinquishing. And I would say also that part of the and the flavor of so many of the Buddha's teachings are trying to incline the mind to dispassion, disenchantment. And so that there is a relinquishing, releasing. And say, like vimokkha that I pointed to before I started reading the sutta is also, release is another translation. So.
Is it a bit like the things are still there, but the relationship to them, the signs of those things, is empty. So it's not, it seems to me, you know, I was thinking the same thing. If any things arise, signs of things, they just arise, but the relationship of the person who is in that state of signness, it does have no effect. It's actually of a relationship to those things, rather than the things themselves. So it has no contact, feeling, perception kind of things. The aggregates don't get involved. Is that... Because you can still see. They can still see and hear and things. That's the impression I'm getting. But at the same time, because you're living in the world, you're not attached to those things and don't get affected in the same way as...
I would say that's Lumbo Chao would often make the distinction of holding but not clinging, and that's his very sort of clear and direct way that, because oftentimes when he would talk about sort of letting go or non-attachment or emptiness, then people would take that to be, oh, so you're just sort of spacing out, or how would you go to work, you know, how do you look after the family if you're contemplating emptiness? And you could always hear Lumbo Chao's eyes rolling. you do it, but with a heart that lets go. With a chitwan is an empty mind, an empty heart. So that it's, and that would be his very tangible and practical way, that you pick something up, and you pick it up. It's not a problem. There's no suffering involved. You pick it up because you need to pick it up. When you don't need it anymore, you put it down. So holding our responsibilities, what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, yes. But it's the mind that then grasps and identifies that, you know, this is my bookmark. What does it really mean? Yeah. Where did it come from? You know, who made this? Yeah. And the kind of grasping and story making and identification around the perceptions. So that's a very simple, very clear standard we've inherited from Lumbo Chao. That's so useful. Just feeling the difference between holding and grasping, and learning how to hold this life without grasping. So it's not a rejecting or a fearing the sense world. And many of Lumbo Chao's Dhamma teachings are about consciously using the sense world for the development of wisdom. And that sense contact, the fount of wisdom, is one of the kind of very, very significant talks in his collected teachings. So it's not a matter of shying away or kind of disconnecting from the sense world, but learning how to hold without grasping. The disconnecting from the sense world in that what you were asking about, when the Buddha is saying, like, his body is like an old cart held together with strings and straps, and the only way he can feel comfort is to absorb into the kind of animitta cetto samadhi, the sinus concentration of mind. It's kind of like a very wholesome sort of anesthetic, like, just... I just check out of the sense world for a bit, just for a bit of physical relief. So he's wide awake, but the attention is just uncoupled from the sources of painful feeling. So it's a state of alertness, unlike anesthesia, where you're unconscious.
Yeah, and it's very restful. Because pain is, it tires you out.
And you were kind of meshing together two things there, that that comment that the Buddha makes at the beginning of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when he's comparing his body to an old cart. But it's about half a dozen, maybe seven or eight times, you find this this expression he uses when he's giving a Dhamma talk, and he says, the assembly is awake, my back is paining me. I'm going to go and stretch it. Mahakachana or Sariputta, Moggallana or Revata, you know, the assembly is still wide awake, carry on giving a Dhamma talk. And so that he, as was saying a few days ago, that I feel that's a tremendously significant teaching, that the Buddha is ready to take action to relieve the pain of his body. He's incapable of suffering, but he's realizing as he's giving a Dhamma talk, that the pain in the body is such that it would be more helpful in the bigger picture to go stretch the body out, relieve the discomfort in the body, and somebody else can carry on giving a Dhamma talk. But I feel that readiness of the fully enlightened Buddha incapable of suffering, still takes steps to compassionately work with his body and its limitations, and isn't shy to say, you know, Sariputta, can you, you know, you take over. I'm going to go and stretch my back. Yes.
I was just going to say that the principle of letting go is that nothing's destroyed. And the lack of confidence we have in letting go is the imagined is our continuing attachment to something remaining. So if we are really unwilling to let go, what we mean is we're not buying into the future, so that there's no future creation because of the letting go. But the thing in itself isn't destroyed, it's just that it has no future, in a sense, because the future comes out of our attachment to it. So this in the context of what happens to the Buddha and when he dies or something is means nothing in the context. So if you're not creating a future, how can that question be significant? But on the other hand, when everything is let go of, nothing is destroyed. So there he is. He's still there.
Yeah.
But there's no future. Two different. It kind of connects the how we attach to the idea that, so what happens to the Buddha when he dies is only coming from our sense of attachment.
Indeed, it's only people who are less than not stream enterers who ask that question. But that question comes from identification with the five khandhas. You never find an Arya asking the Buddha that question.
The terse sort of statement that Ajahn Chah or a samana is one with no future. Which we're pretty hopeless, all right. but it's all takes a whole on a whole other meaning when you sort of realize, we're not having to create time.
In Animitta Samadhi, is the mind one pointed or just sharp? Is it a sort of, does it fall into the world of jhana?
Well, I mean, Samadhi is in the realm of jhana, but then then you start looking at, what are you calling one pointedness? Because it's the. There's some great distinctions of even in the suttas of how the Buddha describes samadhi, and I'm spacing right now, but that samadhi is the unification of mind with relinquishment as its object. That's one of the most beautiful descriptions from the suttas to me.
Also, the expression Lumpo Sameda uses, that the point which includes rather than the point which excludes. And so the very signlessness of that animitta. Like within that there's a non, well, it's in the, what the word implies is that the attention isn't going to a particular feature. So it's without features, without signs, there isn't any feature, and so that there's a quality of great openness, vastness that's implied in that. So signlessness is. I think would be also equated with spaciousness and formlessness. The mind's not the whole idea of a point or a sort of a single object doesn't really pertain in that. Just in the description of those kind of qualities, the states of mind.
Yes.
In physics, there's this is it, when you look, you kind of see what it is, but when you don't look, you don't know, so kind of the decision is made when you look. What is that called again?
Right. It's called a participatory reality.
Okay, so I just had, I thought, is it like, and so Nibbana, is it like you could look, and you, like, we always look, but actually we don't need to look, we don't need to kind of, like, know what it is?
Well, I mean, yeah, in a certain level, that's exactly what it is, in the sense that, you know, because one of the descriptions, of, say, of the Dhamma and therefore of Nibbana is apparent here and now. And but unfortunately, it's not apparent here and now to most people, because they're looking elsewhere, looking in the wrong way, looking in ways that entangle, so that it's how one looks at experience and relates to it that opens the door to that experience, freedom of Nibbana. Any thoughts?
I didn't quite understand the question, to be honest.
Oh.
If you could say the question, I mean, I was impressed that you were able to pick that up and respond. So I got as far as what? Huh? I couldn't. The distinction in physics is that in the subatomic world, you can't meaningfully talk about an observer, because the way that the experimenter looks creates what is observed. So they talk about a participator rather than an experimenter or an observer. So that the way in which something is studied. Ajahn Kachana has a PhD in physics, so he's knowledgeably, I'm grateful to see he's nodding at my description. So I'm not quite sure how that connected with seeing Nibbana. And the way you were phrasing things, your phraseology lost me. So.
Yeah, I think I use in my work, these words kind of apply, but I don't think it's kind of official. I can't phrase the language as good as I can, the question as good as I can. So I had this image that, yeah, like, it's, you kind of, but I think I cannot phrase the question. But you just, you're the participator, you're like, to, we're the observer, but we need to step back and become the participator. Does that make sense?
Well, one of the things that comes to mind is with in some of the suttas, you get a succession of that's described by the Buddha of, you know, hearing the Dhamma, understanding the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, realizing the Dhamma. And then that's not uncommon, that kind of, in various different descriptions. Lumpo Cha added a final element, which was being Dhamma, which you don't have phrased in that way in the suttas, but which Lumpo Cha once in a while use that as a sort of finale, the kind of, and so that rather than there being, oh, here is this mind observing the Dhamma or realizing the Dhamma, Yolampu Cha is his sort of final element in that process is being Dhamma, is like recognizing, oh, what is knowing the Dhamma isn't any kind of a me or any kind of anything external. This is Dhamma knowing itself. The mind is Dhamma, the object is Dhamma, the awareness is Dhamma. It's all Dhamma. Inside is Dhamma, outside is Dhamma, everything is Dhamma. So that, and then you can hear those words, and then the mind can grasp that as a concept. Oh, so I am the Dhamma, that's what I am. Oh, get that on a T-shirt, put it on a mug, you know, ta-da. But that's what we do as humans, you know, we kind of love that kind of... But it's a moment by moment, if one can use that language, it's an embodiment of Dhamma. So that's always what the jitta has been. It's not like it wasn't Dhamma and then it became it. That has been the fabric of reality from the get-go, of this reality of these beings and everything. So that I find that's a very helpful contemplation in terms of meditation and as a theme to just being Dhamma. And I like to use that as an active contemplation, just bringing that into consciousness, into awareness, to say, this isn't me realizing the Dhamma, this is Dhamma realizing the me, or the different me's that come and go. And so, again, that can sound very inflated, like, I'm the Dhamma, I'm the ultimate reality, that's what I am. But that's just a kind of inflated idea. In the actual realization or embodiment of that, that view or that knowing, then that's not a self-centered thing. It's not an ego-centered thing. It's recognizing that quality. So that reflection of Lumpur Cha is like being Dhamma. That can be just bringing that into the picture. Or using a phrase like Dhamma knowing its own nature. They're just to rejig the habits of identification and I-making and mind-making, ahankara, mamankara, to disengage those habits, and to sort of reformulate or clarify the quality of knowing. So it's that... And it might be that bringing that as a theme into consciousness in the meditation, you know, over and over again, maybe just for a finger snap, something goes, oh, and there's an actual embodiment of that just a brief moment. There's a clarity. Oh, this is Dhamma knowing its own nature. Oh, and then the personal habits can jump in and fill the picture again. But even if it's just for a moment, just for the briefest time, that's valuable. It sort of resets clarifies the ground of practice. And do you have any... I mean, Paul Breiter used that as a theme for his being Dhamma as the title for...
Well, I mean, it was something that Ajahn Chah would use in terms of, you know, encouraging, in terms of practice. So you know, first you have to know the Dhamma, then you have to see the Dhamma, but then you have to be the Dhamma. So
does that make sense?
Yes, I understand. What you're realizing is the ocean.
Something like that.
I need to be this and that, and then it realizes, but I'm also the ocean. I'm part of the whole thing.
Yeah, all analogies are partially accurate, but yeah, it's like going from being the wave trying to realize or connect with the ocean, realizing, oh, I have never been anything other than the ocean from the get-go. Tutiampi, all analogies are partially accurate or relevant, but the wave longing to be reconnected to the ocean is what we do as a lot as human beings. Like, if only I could find the Dhamma somewhere. Sanditiko, akariko, ehipasiko. Those terms are apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation. They're supporting that sense of, well, look what's here. Dhamma is not anywhere else. It's not outside, it's not other. Speaking of time?
Time.
Time.